So now, with respect to this course has three themes. One is introduction, and with respect to introduction, the primary challenge is, how do you use derivative products? Who sells them? Where do you buy them? What are the type of people you interact with? What type of questions do you need to answer when you interact with those people, right? So in most cases, a large chunk of the cases, you would not go to the corner store or Lulu supermarket and say, you know, give me a forward contract on oil, or give me a future contract on euro dollars. In most cases, you go to a treasury, which is either part of a bank or an investment bank. And in most cases, you're not an individual, you are an institution. So two treasuries, a corporate on this side and FI on the other side, interact when they interact and deal with this type of product. So we need to understand the language of treasury. We need to understand the term and terminology of treasury. We need to understand the operating environment in which these products are sold. And we'll spend about maybe 10 minutes in today's class in just laying the groundwork for what exactly the treasury function and how does that work. And it's useful information. It's useful information because whether you're on this side or on this side, whether you're on the corporate side or on the FI side, on the banking side or on the buying side, you need to understand both the language, the terminology, and the context. That's part one. Part two is products. So by the time I'm done with you over the next 5 or 6 days, your vocabulary with respect to the terminology in this field will be a lot more richer. And you'll be able to name structures, work with those structures. Even when we come to pricing, price some of those structures. Okay. So that's the second piece, the product vocabulary or the product knowledge. Now the third piece is, it's one thing to say, yes, I understand what a forward rate agreement is, or an IRS is, or a compound option is, or a sell buy or a buy sell swap is, or a repurchase agreement is, or a butterfly trade is, you know, or an exotic contract is. It's one thing to say this. It's a completely different thing to price it, or to figure out how to manage its risk, or to explain it to an audience. Right? When you deal with corporate customers, and especially when you deal with corporate customers at a high level, you don't want to throw this terminology. You want to talk to them in buzzwords. Because when you talk to them in buzzwords, you're admitting that I'm stupid enough to know enough about the subject to stand in front of you and use a word that shows my ignorance. Because if I was a real, you know, guru in the subject, I should be able to explain to you in the language that you understand so that the two of us can sit down and work together, right? But the minute you start using buzzwords, there's a good chance that you lose the audience on the other side, unless and until they're desperate. Or they would find a better banker who can sit with them and explain to them and talk to them in the language they need to work with. Right? So the most important thing is that we want to build a Rosetta Stone where you have vocabulary, terminology, difficult words on this side, and simple, you know, grandmotherly English language descriptions on this side. And we want to have this here. And the best way of having this here is to actually price the structure in Excel. Because once you price it in Excel, you actually see A plus B plus C gets you D. Till you do it with your own hands, it is difficult for you to either remember, understand, or appreciate how a structure actually works. So the pricing in Excel piece is the most important piece. Now, when I teach this course, I teach this course with two orientations. I teach this course from a pure product marketing orientation. So most of the treasury workshops that I run have no pricing elements in it. Product universe, customer application. Product universe, customer application, and maybe a few cases in example. In this course, what we're going to do is we're going to go through the product universe and the customer applications very, very quickly in the next 2 days. When you work for a bank, or treasury sort of is a function that is responsible for doing a lot of things. Primarily, it is responsible for making sure that the bank has enough cash, enough liquidity, has presence in the markets in which it operates. Right? When you work for a corporate, a treasury has more or less the same role. The difference between a treasury at a bank and a treasury at a corporate is treasury at a bank works for the bank, but also does a lot of work for the bank's customers. Treasury at a corporate works primarily for the corporate. Now, it depends on the nature and type of a corporate. If you're a corporate that goes out and borrows a lot of money, the treasury is responsible for making sure that the interest costs, the interest expense of those borrowings is reasonable and is managed well, that there is no liquidity crunch. You know, you shouldn't have a $10 billion bond maturing 4 days before your next $20 billion issue is coming through. Right. Ideally, this should happen before. The issue should happen before. The maturity should happen later. In addition to this, they're also responsible for making sure that the corporate accounts have sufficient cash to make payments. If you're an entity that generates a lot of cash, then the corporate treasury is responsible for parking that cash and earning a decent return on it. So for example, if you're Apple computers, you have more cash than God, you need to figure out, you know, what do you do with it? Once upon a time, that role was held by Microsoft, now it's held by Google. The primary question is, you're either responsible for figuring out what to do with the money you have, or figure out what to do with the money you borrowed, or to figure out what to do with the money that you would need in the future, and where that would come from on this side. And on the banking side, you're responsible for running a large part of the bank. So it's a small team, you know. But in a typical banking environment, some of the largest customers that I've dealt with have had a treasury team, which when I say a treasury team, a treasury has multiple components, but this is a specific group, the people who do the dealing, the traders. A group of 6 to 7 traders could very easily run a book of as much as $10 to $15 billion. What's the tolerance for wasting time? No tolerance, right? So they're short on time. So the one thing that you would notice as you deal with treasury and treasury resources is that they're generally very reasonably smart, very low tolerance for wasting time, especially during trading hours. The way that they make money is very simple. The first thing that they do, and which is what they're very good at, is irrespective of which market they operate in. If I operate in money market, which is fixed income, if I operate in FX, which is foreign exchange, if I operate in equities and capital markets, which is share market, one thing that they do very, very well is they understand what is the true price of a given security at a given time. Now, when I say true price has many meaning. In the context of our discussion, what is the right market price? And there is a term around this which is known as price discovery. It basically means that you buy, sell till you figure out what the right price is, right? So treasurers and traders are very good at discovering what the right price for a trade is. Or they have very good sense or intuition for discovering what the right price for a trade is. So if you look at, let's say, a mid-sized bank in the US, a mid-sized bank in the US would generate anywhere between 6 to 10,000 tickets a day. If a mid-sized treasury in, let's say, Karachi, a mid-sized treasury in Karachi would do anywhere between 100 to 150 tickets a day. So when you're quoting prices, and you're, let's say your operating hours are about 4 hours where the bulk of your transactions and traffic and trade happens, which is, let's say, between 10 to 2, depending on what the dealing hours are in your market. And you're quoting prices on such a regular basis, you get a good sense for what prices are, where they're likely to be. If they go high, how high they'll go. If they come low, how low they'll come. What is the threshold at which, you know, the market will intervene and react? What's the threshold at which the market will intervene and react on this side? So how low can it go? Sorry, how high can it go? How low can it go? So this price discovery process comes primarily from interacting, trading, assimilating information, exchanging information, building an intuition for how things are put together. So what type of people work within the treasury group? Not always smart people, but 60 to 80% of the time, reasonably smart people. Very quick reflexes, not in terms of running from here to there in under 6 seconds, but in terms of reacting to changes in market, in terms of anticipating what the market is likely to do if a certain piece of news breaks, in terms of tracking that today this piece of news is going to come out. If it goes this way, this is how the market will go. If it goes that way, this is how the market will go. And making money on both sides. So, which means that your mindset always then is, how can I make money with a trade? And it's not enough and sufficient for you to just look at the information. You cannot come to the office, look at the screen and say, oh, there's an ECB meeting today. We should do something. Ideally, you would know 3 to 6 months in advance that there is an ECB meeting today and it's likely to go in this direction, and based on the direction the ECB meeting takes, here's your exposure on this side, here's your exposure on that side, if you take that. You're prepared for it and you react to it. So investment banking is one field, sales and trading is one field, treasury function in banking is one field. Primary problem getting a treasury role is these guys have no time. They have no time to teach. They have no time to invest in your development. They have no time to sit down with you and explain how a transaction or trade would work. They have no time to sit down and tell you how pricing would work. And the reason why this course is very important is that effectively, if you work hard and you apply yourself, you'll at least be able to maybe not maintain an intelligent conversation, but at least start an intelligent conversation. And what I would do is, I would think of this as, you know, you're all working for Goldman for the next 7 days. And this is sort of an empty program for Goldman. And what you're trying to do is impress the MD, which is me, by asking me difficult questions that I cannot answer. Which means you have to not just read the material here, But do whatever you can to discover more about some of the structures and products that we are going to go out and price. As well as think about, how would I break this model? How would I make money with this model? How would I trade against this model? How would I know that Jawad is absolutely sure that this is the right price? How would I question the price? What would I do to answer my MD if he started questioning my model? How would I ensure that he would be satisfied and comfortable with the material and the work that I have done and the price that I have? There are three things. The first thing is price discovery. How much is this worth, really worth? And then depending on how much is it really worth, how can I make a cent or 2 cents or 3 cents when I trade this? So number one. Number two is there are no buyers or sellers for this. So how do I figure out to give a two-way quote, which means that I'm in the market to both buy and sell. Normally, when we think in terms of a transaction or a trade, we only think in terms of one step, us and the buyer, us and the seller. In terms of both derivative products and treasury products, what you need to get comfortable with is this concept of multiple parties and trying to figure out where you stand, and then based on where you stand, where prices are, and based on where prices are, what's the price that you would quote. The second piece is market making. What is market making? So think of market making as a very simple concept. I want to make a market in black whiteboard markers. Now if I want to do this, I will have to sell them if he comes to sell them. I have to buy them if he wants to buy them. So I have to do a give and take on both sides. At any given point in time, I have an inventory. I am trying to track my cost of that inventory so that when I buy and sell, you know, I'm always pushing my average cost down by buying at below my cost, and I'm always pushing my average price higher by selling at above my cost. Right? Same concept. Now take this same concept to a bond, which is a liquid. It is a liquid because there are no buyers and sellers in the market. But if you become known as a person who's buying and selling that bond, you are now a market maker. People will come to you and say, now when you buy and sell, doesn't mean that you're going to always hold it in your inventory or on your book. Depending on who you are and how strong you are and how actively you understand the market, you may know that, you know, Ganesh is interested in buying that bond, or Nikhil is interested in buying that bond. And whenever you get a quote from Glenda, you say, you know, let me check with Priyank, see if he's interested. And you call him and say, you know, I have Hopco, TFCs, or Skooks selling at X, are you interested? This amount. She says yes. So you call her back and tell her that, okay, I have a buyer at this price. Are you interested in selling? If you are, end of deal. Confirm, transaction executed, right? So this is the market making function. Now most brokers do a similar function. If you look at exchanges do exactly the same thing. Exchanges bring lots of buyers and sellers together and allow those buyers and sellers to sell and trade and interact with each other and figure out what the price is. So second thing that a treasury does, and that you're supposed to do if you're a trader, is that depending on the mandate you have as a group, you would possibly want to specialize in one or two securities or trades. So there are traders who specialize in treasury bills, traders who specialize in currencies, traders who specialize in corporate bonds, traders who specialize in commodities. So the second thing is market making. The third piece is what we call spread management. Now spread management within a bank or an investment bank is, I want to restrict my cost of funding to a level reasonably below the rate that I can earn on my advances and loans on my book. So I want to make sure that my cost is less than my earnings. Now, why are these three skills important? These three skills are important within the context of the derivative course because with respect to spread management and market making, you will have a model price. But whether the market accepts that price is a completely separate story. So within this, there are three pieces. One is, who do you know? How many people will call you when they need a specific trade done? One is access. When you do get that call, do you have access to the resources in the market who would buy or sell? And the third is discipline. What's the right point for you to get out, even if it means that you have to book a loss? Scenario one, you're a trader at the treasury. You have a customer calls. The customer says, I have a payment. Why? Because last month I imported 200 BMW 7 Series for my showroom. And let's assume that they all cost about a million dirhams. 200 BMWs at 1 million dirhams. That's my dirham exposure, right? Because that's what I can sell them in the local market for. So I have 200 million dirhams. Let's say the exchange rate is 4.0 AED to a euro. 1 euro will give you 4 AEDs. So I have to make a payment of 50 million, right? Now, I don't have to make this payment now. I have to make this payment in 150 days. Okay, so what would be good news? So if you have to make a payment of 50 million euros and the exchange rate right now is 4, you have 150 days to make this payment. What's the best that can happen and what's the worst that can happen? So AED appreciates, euro depreciates, right? Okay, now what's the worst case? In actual currency terms, at 4, at the exchange rate of 4 dirhams to a euro, 50 million euros will cost you 200 million dirhams. At an exchange rate of 5 euros to a dirham, 50 million euros will cost you 250 million dirhams. At a rate of 3, 50 million will cost you 150. The proceeds that you would generate from the sale, you will generate 200 million dirhams by selling these cars, because each of these cars sells for a million dirhams. So in 150 days, if all you will generate is that amount, all you want to do is make sure that in 150 days when you sell these BMWs at, let's say, 1 beamer a day, you don't have to pay more than 200 million. That's what you want. Okay. So now you call the trader and you tell the trader, I have a payment to make in 150 days of how much? 50 million euros. So what can we do? Buyer, so the customer is the local dealer of the BMW franchise. Let's say it's Altair. Let's assume it's Alphatem, right? So Alphatem is called who? Alphatem is called their banker. And when Alphatem calls their banker, how does the sequence work? Alphatem calls their banker. Alphatem says, I have a payment of 150 million euros to make. There are a few things that need to be in order. There are a few things that need to be in place. What are those few things? First thing is, let's assume that we agree on a transaction. Let's assume that the trader says that what do you want to do? You want to buy 50 million euros. What is the bank doing? The bank is selling 50 million euros 150 days from now. Under what condition would Alphatem default? Now, if Alphatem can get the same 50 million for 150, should Alphatem pay the extra 50? It wouldn't. Right? So there is a risk of default. So their market cost would be 150 million dirhams. Their cost from the FGP transaction is going to be 200 million dirhams. You'll actually book a mark-to-market loss of 50 million dirhams on the transaction if they go forward with it. Now the problem with the bank has is that the bank entered the transaction on time zero, on day zero. The bank doesn't keep these transactions on its books. The bank also squares them, or hedges them, or nets them, or cancels them out, which means that once the bank had Alphatem in here, the bank then went out and did a second deal with an interbank counterparty, where the bank, what was the bank doing? The bank was selling 50 million euros? The bank bought 50 million euros. The bank is selling at 4, right? So possibly the bank bought 50 million euros at 3.98. So it bought them at 3.98, didn't buy them there and then, bought them for delivery 150 days. The bank would receive 50 million euros, 150 days. As soon as it received it, it would give them to Alphatem, and Alphatem will give it the money. Now that Alphatem's defaulted on the 150th day, the bank has received 50 million euros at an exchange rate of 3.98, whereas the market rate and the market prices. So this is known as the risk of counterparty default. And the risk is not just limited to FX transactions or forward transactions. The risk is applicable to any transaction where you'd agree to buy a security at a certain price, and the risk is that the price of the security when you decide to settle the transaction comes down. And the counterparty says, why should I buy at this price? I can buy from the market at a lower price. So this is known as counterparty risk or counterparty risk or counterparty default. It is also known as, in risk management terms, known as PSR or pre-settlement risk. Now, same concept, oil. Customer needs to buy 10 million barrels of oil 30 days down the road. Customer likes the oil prices now, is worried that they'll go to 100. Customer wants to secure himself. Customer enters into a forward transaction with the bank where the bank will sell the customer 10 million barrels of oil and the customer will pay the bank a certain price per barrel. How would this work? Now the customer comes back and says, listen, I have to buy 10 million barrels of oil. How can you help me? In commodities, you would actually see, more likely to see, something called what we call NYMEX, which is New York Mercantile Exchange, ICE, which is Intercontinental Exchange, right? So NYMEX is New York, ICE is London. Now how is this different? Future contract, right? How is the future contract different? So in this case, the counterparty is the exchange. We all deal with the exchange and the exchange decides whether to pair this trade or this trade with this trade, right? The only difference between a forward transaction and a future transaction is that a future transaction comes with a margin, okay? So if this customer wants to do $10 million, let's say oil is right now trading at $80 per barrel, so 10 million times 80 is how much? 800 million, right? So the exchange would say, if you want to place an order on NYMEX or ICE for $800 million, you would need to pay a margin. So the exchange will take a deposit, and then depending on whether prices go up or come down, this margin will adjust accordingly. Now, from a exposure point of view, all the collateral does, this margin does, is ensure that if the customer defaults, the exchange has sufficient depth to protect itself. So from a payoff point of view, if you were to draw the payoff profile of a forward contract or a future contract, the payoff profile, end result exposure will be the same. The only thing that will be different will be the logistics of managing the margin account. So with a bank, you have a limit which effectively serves as a margin account on a forward contract. So now before we move away from forwards, let's talk a bit about very interesting variation of a forward contract that you're very likely to see when you work in this part of the world. So the transaction I'm going to describe is common in the developing world, in markets where interest rates are higher, sometimes in markets where interest rates are not that high. But it makes sense when you look at it from a high interest rate environment, right? So let's start with India and Pakistan, right? The rate that we're interested in is known as the money market rate. And when we say money market stands for fixed income. Now within this, there are three or four rates that we're interested in. One rate is what we call the discount window or the discount rate. This is the rate at which you can borrow money from the central bank. Then there is an interbank rate. Interbank rate is the rate at which banks interact, lend as well as borrow from each other. So it's specifically limited to a financial institution. If you're an FI, you can borrow and participate and lend in the interbank market. If you're not an FI, you can't tap funds from the interbank market. Right, so now here's a very, very simple, very, very basic trade. What's a simple and basic trade? In our market, which is Pakistan, I don't think in India this is allowed. In our market, a bank can raise foreign currency deposits. So you can go to a bank and say, I've got $10,000, I'd like to open a dollar account. You deposit $10,000 in cash with the bank. If a bank has foreign currency deposits, so let's say I'm sitting on $10 million in deposits. Right now, if I keep this money in my Nostro account, which is basically my counterparty in the US, the US dollar settles in New York. So if you're sitting on $10 million in your Nostro account, what are you earning on that $10 million? running 0.25. How much is 0.25% of $10 million? All right. So $25,000 is all you'll make if you keep this money for a year with your Nostro account in the US. Right? Now, because the bank deals on a regular basis in the interbank market, the interbank market in, let's say, Pakistan runs at about 12%. So on one hand, the bank has $10 million in Nostro account in the US. On the other hand, if it needs to borrow money from the local market, it can only borrow money at 12%. And there is this huge difference. It has an asset on which it's earning 25 basis points, only 25 basis points. It has liabilities on which it's paying 12%. The bank says, what can I do? The bank says, let's sell these dollars. And let's sell them today. If we sell them today, let's assume the exchange rate is 100. If I sell 10 million US dollars at an exchange rate of 100, what do I get? I get 1 billion PKR. Now this 1 billion PKR, I can invest or lend at 12%. If I invest and lend at 12%, how much will I earn? 120 million, right? 120 million is how much in dollar terms? So if I did this, right, rather than earning $25,000, I will earn how much? $1.2 million. Makes sense, right? Would you go for it? What's the risk? Risk is PKR depreciate. Risk is, the reason why the exchange rate is 12% is because there is an interest rate differential between the USD rate and the PKR rate, right? Why does the interest rate differential exist? It exists because there's an inflation differential. The reason why there is a differential in interest rates is because there is a differential in inflation, there's a differential in expectations, there's a differential in what people anticipate the market to do, okay? And because of this, there's a chance that a year or 6 months down the road, the rupee would no longer be at 100. It may be at 110. If it is at 110, when you convert your rupees into USD, you may not get your full $10 million. So I got to say, okay, let me structure this transaction in such a fashion that I do two things. The first thing is I sell dollars. And I sell dollars and get PKR. Then I can do whatever I want them. But then at the same time, I also agree to buy dollars. So when I buy dollars 1 year from now, what am I doing? I'm actually entering into a forward transaction. And when I do this forward transaction, does it happen at 100? It happens at the forward rate, right? That forward rate is calculated by the differential between the expected inflation rates and the anticipated expected interest rates. And let's assume that rate is 109. So I sell $10 million at 100 today, and I agree to buy back $10 million at 109 a year from now. So at the end of 1 year, what happens? At the end of 1 year, my 1 billion plus 120 million, 2.8, which is still more than the 25 basis point or 25,000 USD I would have made if I'd kept my money in US dollars. So this transaction is called an FX swap. The intent is, I have liquidity in this market. I am short. Because I have liquidity in this market, I want to utilize this liquidity. And I utilize in such a fashion that I am not taking any FX exposure. My net open position is still $10 million, because I'm buying $10 million a year from now. As long as I earn 12% and change, 12% and more, on these rates, I will always make about 2.5% more than what I would get if I kept that money in my Nostro account. So the 2% arbitrage. Now this 2% arbitrage is actually created by the central bank. The 2% arbitrage is created by the central bank so that there's an incentive for dollars to remain invested in local currency terms. The central bank is paying 2.5% penalty, it's paying a 2.5% premium for you to keep your dollars invested in the local market. And the reason why I said, you know, the reason why this happens, it happens in high interest, developing countries, developing markets, mainly because the central bank needs the dollar. This would happen primarily in developing countries, developing markets, where the central bank has an incentive or a reason to keep dollars invested in the local market. Now there is one transaction which is an important transaction, and that transaction is bill discounting or acceptances or trade finance. Now the primary difference between bill discounting and FX forward sale purchase is what? How does the customer conversation change when you do a bill discounting transaction? What is the intent? Bill discounting is again an interesting package transaction. It's a package transaction just like the swap, where it uses the forward contract to create an interesting payment structure.